Good morning, everybody. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by engineer extraordinaire Terry Wilson. And we're really happy to have as our guest this morning, Zeddy Nemlowel. Did I say that properly?
You sure did. Thanks for having me. I feel like I finally made it being on Jim Wilkins' show.
Well, I might remind you, Zeddy, that when you came up here from Eugene, you kind of helped me with this show for a little while there, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I worked in broadcast news, and I was a TV news anchor. It had taken me about 5 years to move up through the ranks at a TV station there, starting as an intern. And, you know, I was at a pretty good place there, and I wanted to move back home to Astoria. And I kind of had to start, at the bottom of the ladder in certain regards again. And I didn't have a job when I came back here, and you gave me a great opportunity to get my foot in the door at KMUN by producing your talk show.
Yeah, I remember running into you at lunch down at the Columbian Cafe, and all of a sudden, Zeddy was my producer. It was wonderful. Now, I like to start out with a little bit of biographical kind of stuff, Zeddy, so why don't you take us through that? You were born,
you were buddies and roommates, I think, with my dad, and you guys came to Astoria in sort of the first wave of artists and musicians that came to town. My dad built a house out in Olney, and I was born there in that house, actually. I went to school in Astoria and also in Maui as my mom moved there when I was in high school. So I kind of had this interesting cultural experience there, and I learned that I was white. It was nothing that I'd ever been aware of before. But the culture there is real different. You know, I went to a public school there, and fortunately, I was able to become friends with the locals there and really enjoyed that experience. But again, wanted to come home and go to college in Oregon, and so I went to U of O. Majored in journalism with a focus on electronic media, minored in Spanish, got to study in Mexico. And then, as I had mentioned, you know, I worked my way up the ranks there at a NBC affiliate in Eugene. And then I moved home to Astoria, and I started working at KMUN in broadcast and KAST.
Weren't you in Eugene? Didn't you work your way up to being a talking head?
Yes, I was. I read a teleprompter. There was a lot of improv there, though. And also, I wrote a lot of those scripts and produced a lot of those shows. So I'd like to think I was more than a talking head. But yeah, I really enjoyed that work. But, you know, I didn't really want to move to a bigger city at the time. I wanted to come back to Astoria. And I figured if I missed it too much, I would get back into it and move to a bigger city and do that again. But, you know, I think Astoria is my home, and I don't have any plans to leave. It's been, over 10 years now since I've returned as an adult.
Well, let's back up just a little bit and talk about your time on Maui. As you know, I spent some time there, owned property on Maui, and developed a real kind of appreciation of the native culture there. Could you talk a little bit about that Hawaiian culture that we learned about?
Wow, the Hawaiian culture there it's just so beautiful. I think the people have a love for the land they call the Aina, and it's easy to see when you're there because it's just so beautiful. And there's, the Hawaiian Islands were formed by volcanoes. There's no active volcanoes on Maui, of course, right now. But Pele, the spirit of volcanoes, is very strong there. I think the people are really spiritual. I remember on the school grounds, Tongan guys walking through the schoolyard at lunchtime with...
In Kahului?
In Kahului. Yep, Baldwin High, walking through the schoolyards, playing the ukulele at lunchtime. That's definitely not something that happened at Astoria High School.
No, you don't see many ukulele players around here.
No, except for my dad. He collects a lot of ukuleles.
Yeah. Well, since then, you know, you've been doing a lot of various things. Well, and one of the things I'd like to talk about is your experience with land use planning. I know you're on the Planning Commission. And how long have you been on the Planning Commission?
Well, I just started my third term, so that means I've got 8 years under my belt, and I'm president of the commission. This is my third year leading the meetings.
So how has that been? Have you had any controversial stuff come up?
Well, it's kind of interesting because things have been pretty quiet at the Planning Commission for a while now. However, recently we've been pretty busy implementing the Riverfront Vision Plan. The controversial issues that I've dealt with really did come when there were a lot of condo proposals over the waterfront.
Yes.
At one time, I think there were 17 talked about residential developments either near the water or over the water. And that spurred a lot of fear in the community about there kind of being a wall blocking off the water from the citizens. And that's really what prompted the Riverfront Vision Plan, which was adopted in 2009. We didn't really hear anything about that until now. The Riverfront Vision Plan hasn't had any teeth because it hasn't been adopted into the code, and that's what we're working on right now. So we've had a series of work sessions with staff and a consultant, and right now staff and the consultant are developing code language. And we're going to be taking a look at that at a meeting coming up, actually, on February 25th, starting at 6:30. And, if you have any interest at all in the river and views, I would certainly encourage you and anyone else to attend that meeting because we're still taking public comment. It's interesting time because there are no proposals for development in the area that we're looking at right now. We're just looking at the stretch from the Maritime Museum east to Pier 39. So it's a pretty good time to try to do something like this that would potentially limit development or make it so there would be no development possible on the waterfront in that area, because almost all the public comment we've heard is in favor of protecting the views.
You know, on the Planning Commission and the issues that you're talking about right now is really kind of where the controversy erupts between personal property rights and the benefit of the overall community. And that's been an issue since Senate Bill 100, actually, in 1972. How do you guys deal with that particular dichotomy?
Well, as planning commissioners, we're charged to look at the public interest. It's really challenging when we've got a developer who has a project on the table to not look at them in a personal way and think about how it might benefit them, or even something as small as, somebody wanting a variance to have a higher fence than would be allowed in code. It's hard to just not say, oh, sure, you can have that. But, in my mind, I'm always thinking, what's good for Astoria? Mm-hmm. And so as long as that's our mission, it's not hard to try to figure out what's best for the public.
Right. But getting back to the Riverfront Visioning Plan, what kind of developments or lack of developments or what kind of code, what kind of language are you guys looking at implementing?
Well, this particular stretch that I'm talking about is called the Civic Greenway.
And a lot of that's owned by the city, isn't it?
It is. There's pretty small private ownership there that would be impacted by this. Let's see, what was the question again?
Some of the actual specific language and intent of the visioning plan.
Well, we're looking at overwater development. The Riverfront Vision Plan is pretty clear about there being minimal overwater development in that particular stretch. Even this notion of a blue way zone, which would just be water and no development at all. So a question at stake right now is possibly some low-lying docks and water-related uses. So one of the things that we're going to be talking about at the February 25th meeting is height and size. Would the height restrictions be, say, one story or the bank height? So there's those types of issues. The views are really big, and that's what all this development or no development really comes down to. And then also we're talking about a new residential neighborhood, taking the city shops property and potentially rezoning that into housing. So it would kind of extend the neighborhood over from the Mill Pond area.
Yeah, the city is talking about moving the public works shops to the old landfill. How far away are we from actually doing that?
I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that I think you might find interesting is this idea of how could we have housing that would truly be affordable or workforce housing? Housing that people who live and work in Astoria right now could afford to buy. And the consultant that we're working with brought to us the idea of cluster housing.
Mm-hmm.
It's small lots and small houses that might have shared yards or garages or community centers, that type of thing. So that's a new type of development for Astoria.
Well, that's similar to what's been done at Mill Pond, actually, because there was implemented at Mill Pond an overlay zone that decrease the required setbacks and all of that stuff. So is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It's similar but different. We wouldn't see the scale of houses that we see at Mill Pond right now. I mean, a lot of the houses at Mill Pond are, well, let's face it, they're above the average home price in Astoria, and I don't know too many folks who are working class in Astoria who live there.
Hmm.
So this would be different. It's challenging to control the price of houses, but I think the mass of these houses would be a lot smaller, and I think as a result, the cost would be a lot less.
We've just had a question submitted to us from outside the studio, and I will read this. What would have to happen in order to put teeth into the code regarding protecting views, that is, no development on this one small stretch of the Columbia waterfront in Astoria?
Well, currently there's no teeth in the Riverfront Vision Plan because it's not in our code. It's just a planning document. So there's no rules in place if you were to develop right now that are in line with the Riverfront Vision Plan. So adopting code language that reflects the intent of the plan would give it teeth.
Now, there is a, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's a height restriction along that stretch.
There's height restrictions along any stretch of the waterfront that vary, and in any part of town. It just depends on what zone. There's a few areas where there's no height restriction right now along that particular stretch. Just to the east of the Maritime Museum and also the port property at the East Mooring Basin.
Hmm. Gotcha. Well, I see it's time to do my midway promo here for Coast Community Radio. This is Friday, and I'm Jim, and we're visiting today with Zeddy. Zeddy, thanks for being with us here.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Now, any other major issues coming up before the Planning Commission? It sounds like this riverfront visioning is kind of a hot issue right now.
It is. The city has a grant to look at the Civic Greenway, and then after that, we're going to be looking at a stretch called the Bridge Vista. So that's two out of four sections of the Riverfront Vision Plan that we're working on implementing. So that's definitely going to be a lot of work. It goes through the Planning Commission and then to City Council, so there's lots of opportunities for the public to be involved with this. And also, the transportation system plan, we're going to be looking at adopting that. That's been a pretty lengthy process. That would be at a meeting on February 27th. That, too, goes to the City Council. So, again, there's lots of opportunity for public comment on that. But when I'm not at the planning commission and I'm not at home mothering the kids, I'm working at the co-op. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit because the co-op is turning 40 this year.
Well, we'll get to that, but I've still got some more questions that have come in regarding land use.
Oh, so boy.
Here's another one. Can existing waterfront property owners, establish place markers in a way, be grandfathered in? Presently allowed heights and setbacks, or would an owner have to have an approved design in place?
That's a good question, and I would point that person to the Community Development Department.
Here's another question that's been submitted to us, Eddie. Do you know of a mechanism for view preservation? This has proven difficult in other municipalities.
I would say the mechanism for view preservation is what we're working on right now, and that would be limiting height, limiting development over the water. That's what we're looking at right now.
And it sounds like if people are interested in participating in that process, they need to show up at the next meeting, which is February...
It's February 25th at 6:30.
And that would be down at City Hall?
Yep, that's in Council Chambers at City Hall.
Okay. You know, Zeddy wears more than one hat, of course. Probably the most important one right now is she's a mom with three little rascals to take care of. But in addition to that, you are the marketing director of the co-op, is that correct?
That's true.
Talk about that job.
Well, it's a new position at the co-op. The co-op has evolved a lot in 40 years. I hear it started in the living room of Peter Hudala as a buying club. Do you remember the co-op back when it was on Marine Drive?
Yes. Yes, I have to admit I do.
So, and I remember it there too. When Josie Pepper was the manager, I was a little girl and I wanted to... I was very entrepreneurial, let's say, although I was too young to work, so she let me volunteer and fold bags and use the pricing gun, so who would have known that it would lead to this? But anyway, you know, food co-ops across the country have really had to evolve and become more resilient to compete with the stores of now. Not only do we have things like... you know, Kroger's expansions with the Fred Meyer adding more natural foods. But in larger communities, we've also got a lot of private natural food retailers. So marketing and branding, you know, which might sound kind of scary to some co-op owners, is kind of a necessary thing for food co-ops to move forward. So I do all kinds of things there, from planning events to social media, communicating with our owners via email and doing the newsletter, working on some really exciting projects, a couple more farm-to-fork cooking classes in collaboration with Columbia Memorial Hospital. So lots of exciting stuff. And also, you know, there's this feeling at the co-op right now when it gets really busy that we're running out of room and that we have potential. yeah, and that we have potential to add more selection, like fresh meat and fresh seafood, which those are things that we'd like to do in the near future. But we're also taking a look at a strategic plan to engage our community owners in taking a look at the next step. So that's exciting for me.
You know, what kind of a hot button issue right now is CSA, community supported agriculture. Do you actually go out and deal with producers of stuff?
Yeah. Each newsletter, I go out to a local farm and we do this piece called Meet Your Farmer. That's been a really neat experience. We source from several farms within a 40-mile radius. So you hear this term local food. And I feel like the work that we do is truly local. It's neat because, you know, we're a small grocery store, but we're able to use size as an advantage sourcing from these local farms, which are probably too small to sell to bigger retailers. So that's nice because we're able to differentiate by providing this really fresh farm fresh food, and also supporting a local economy. So yeah, I do get out there, and we have a lot of farms that deliver their CSAs to the co-op and people picking up their CSAs there too, just because we feel like that's something that's important to support.
Well, that's certainly true. And given the concern about GMOs lately, how do you identify those? You deal with them at all? Genetically modified.
That's a really important issue. One of our outreach and education activities is a lecture series called Beers to Your Health. It's food and wellness related, and it's at the Level Showroom, so it's adjacent to the Fort George Brewery, which hence the name Beers to Your Health. Anyway, we did a two-part series on GMOs. We had a wheat breeder and a geneticist from OSU come up and talk about GMOs from, you know, a kind of a genetically engineered food will save the world standpoint, which I think is in conflict with probably my view and a lot of co-op shoppers' views. But it was interesting to learn about this side that, you know, thinks genetically modified food is good. And then we had a presentation by our co-op manager, Matthew Stanley, talking about why genetically modified food is bad. The good thing is, if it's certified organic, that means there's no GMOs in it. The co-op is an organization, hasn't taken a stand per se against GMOs, but it's definitely in support of labeling GMOs. So,
Some of the reasons that people are skeptical or wary of GMOs?
Well, it's an unknown. You know, we don't know if they're safe, and the idea of labeling them is giving consumers an ability to choose whether or not they want to be test subjects of GMOs. But in my mind, what makes very rational, concrete sense is some of these crops are developed to withstand Roundup. The Roundup would kill all the weeds, but the soy crop, for example, would still be standing. So that tells me that some of these genetically modified foods might have a lot more chemicals on them, and I really want to keep those away from my family.
Can you think of any studies that have been done indicating that GMOs cause some kind of damage, cellular or otherwise?
Not any specific studies. If you look online for that, there's studies that come out of Europe and other countries that ban GMOs. But as far as the United States, you know, not so much. That's why it's a really controversial issue right now, is there aren't any major studies that I know that have been done in the United States that you know, farmers and the public as a whole are really paying attention to. I could be incorrect on that, but I think that's partly why it's a controversial issue.
And these the GMOs are pretty much limited to the big mega farmers. Is that,
yeah.
I guess what I'm getting at is that some of the people that you buy from within the 40-mile radius, GMOs are not an issue.
No, definitely not. I don't see that as an issue. The only issue I would see is there's kind of a fear that some of these bigger commercial farms, that, you know, the genetically modified crops could spread to the smaller farms. It's kind of been an eye-opening experience working at the co-op in this position for the last year because, frankly, I didn't know anything about GMOs, nor did I really care to know a year ago. But it's been an eye-opening experience, and I've learned a lot about a lot of different subjects, including that. But I feel like I'm just kind of scratching the surface. I feel like there's a lot more to learn.
Well, you're certainly right. But getting back to the co-op, if I understood you correctly, you're kind of getting maxed out in the space down there. Is it time for the co-op to find a bigger place?
Well, I might personally think so, but we are community owned. I think right now, we've got about 2,700 owners, and that doesn't.
I'm one.
Right. So, what do you think? Do you think we're maxed out on space?
I'd have to confer with my wife on that. I don't know.
It's pretty tight in there.
Is it?
Well, that's a question that we're going to be wanting to know. The board, the co-op board just had a retreat, and I think it's pretty fair to say that the board feels comfortable with going through with this strategic plan because of that idea that we might be running out of space. But given the structure of the co-op, that's not something for me to decide right now without going through a process.
Well, we're kind of running low on time here, Zeddy, so I'm hoping we've got 3 minutes left. What other issues would you like to discuss in the remaining 3 minutes?
Oh, gosh. Something that I think about a lot, and I think about this idea of Astoria for Astorians, and I think that's really important. I think about, what is Astoria's niche? Why is it such a special place? And how can we preserve this unique feeling and this unique aesthetic that we have here right now? Because Astoria's changed a lot, in my lifetime. And I think tourism is really important. I mean, it's definitely given me opportunities here as an adult. But I worry a little bit about Astoria housing prices getting to be too high. I want this to be a place where local people can live, work, and play. I want my kids to grow up and be able to come back here like I did. And I think a niche that Astoria has is a second home ownership rate, which is really low. We've got a big year-round community. We're at 3% right now for second home ownership rate.
But that's growing.
It has grown, but by comparison to other coastal communities, which are, the majority of the population leave in the wintertime,
right,
and some businesses aren't sustainable year-round, Astoria's got it going on year-round, and that really makes us unique. And I think that's great not only for people who live here, because we've got a thriving community, but I think it's also great for businesses. So I'd like to think, talking about a strategic plan for the co-op, I'm sort of thinking about a strategic plan for Astoria in how we can identify what we want for the future and how we can foster policies that might make it so we can continue to have this thriving year-round community for local people.
That's certainly true, but how do you determine, or how do you affect the sales price of some of our houses around here? We're limited geographically. There's no real room to expand unless we expand the urban growth boundary. So those prices are caused by supply and demand. Is that true?
Yeah. One thing that's been coming up at Planning Commission lately is requests for vacation rentals and that type of thing on Airbnb. It's a little bit different when the owner occupies the house and they're just renting out a room, but it still is commercializing neighborhoods to a certain extent. And if that happens to a greater degree, I think it'll drive up housing prices because it'll make it more feasible for people to purchase second homes here.
Zeddy, I really appreciate you being with us here today. That half an hour went by remarkably fast. But Terry Wilson, our intrepid engineer, tells me that it's time to wrap this up. So thanks for being with us, Zeddy.
Thank you very much, Jim.